Log Talk Radio.
Hi, and welcome to a very special Rush Hour. My name is Harold Lee Rush, and this program on Blog Talk Radio is a very special program tonight. It's an anniversary program, a special anniversary, marking the 57th anniversary of the assassination of Ted Roe. Now, you'll be able to call in and talk to us in just a few minutes if you are just logging on. I'm going to talk a couple of minutes about a couple of things so that you have a context. Because some of you may be listening and saying, well, who is Ted Roe and why should I care about this? Well, just briefly, Ted Roe was one of the last of the King of the Policy Kings. And for those who are not familiar with what a policy king is, essentially, policy was what was also known as the numbers racket. And that was originally the biggest black-owned and operated business enterprise actually in the world. Now, most of us have a very, very blurry kind of history about policy. But thanks to a gentleman by the name of Nathan Thompson, who spent almost 13 years researching and writing the first definitive book about policy, we now know quite a few things that we did not know before, and that includes people who were around in the policy days. Now, in a little while, we will actually talk live to Nathan Thompson because he is actually en route to the actual location of the assassination of Ted Roe that took place 57 years ago on this date in Chicago, Illinois. Now, the telephone number, if you'd like to call in, is 646-915-8342. That's 646-915-8342. And also, there is a chat room. You should see a link that will allow you to actually come into a chat room. So you can communicate with me via the chat room, or you can also call in. Okay? Now, what we're going to do, I'm going to share a few things about the year 1952 so that you can put some things in context as we talk about the assassination of Ted Roe. You see, one of the things about policy is that it was huge. It was not a nickel-dime operation, as so many people have been led to believe. And it was a game, a business. It was a game that became a business. And it was so huge that at a certain point in time, the mob decided that it needed to take over policy. And this was really after Prohibition, because with Prohibition ended, then the mob was losing control of the liquor business. And so they looked around for other enterprises to get involved with. And one of the things that they learned was that, or they actually knew it already, was that policy was making millions of dollars and black people controlled it. So there began a several decades long war to take over policy by the various mobs. And I want you to understand that when I say mobs, it wasn't just the Italians. There were various mobs. Every ethnic group had their own mob. There was the Italian mob, the Chinese mob, the Irish mob, the Jewish mob. And if you think that I'm making this up, all you have to do is go back and look at the names, even of the gangsters that they had in the movies. But some of them that we know are real. Bugsy Siegel. What is Siegel? Siegel's not Italian, and it ain't Irish. So when you go and look at the various mobs, every ethnic group had mobs. Even black folks had mobs, but the mob, black mob, did not run policy. Okay, that's what you need to understand. Black people, black business people, ran policy. And as I said, it was the biggest black-owned and operated business enterprise in the world. Now, in 1952, just to take you back there in your mind so that you get an idea of what the world was like, so you can understand why the assassination of Ted Roe was so monumental. In 1952, you had such things as Jackie Robinson. He became the highest paid baseball player in Dodger history, but he hadn't been on the team that long. Baseball had not been integrated, quote unquote, that long. In 1952, New York, for the first time, had three colored traffic lights. Yeah, in other words, before that, they just had red and green. In 1952, they decided, well, that's kind of tricky, so let's put up another one. That's when they decided they would put up a yellow light. In 1952, a war was just beginning that was never actually a declared war. It was in a place called Korea. And it just as coincidence, your former president, Bill Clinton, just went to North Korea to free some folks, a couple of people some Americans who were being held there. In 1952, the United States was just beginning its war there, and they sent a lot of brothers up to Korea to fight. Okay? In 1952, a guy by the name of Ronald Reagan and Nancy Davis were getting married in L.A. Now, Nancy Davis was what? Was that his first wife? I don't know. We have to check that out. Also, let's give you a sense of what was going on in terms of movies, things like that. The Academy Awards in 1952, An American in Paris was named the best picture. Humphrey Bogart got the Oscar for Best Actor for The African Queen. Streetcar Named Desire, Carl Malden, got Best Actor. And Best Director went to a guy by the name of George Stevens for a movie called A Place in the Sun. So, and I know for some of the listeners who were around at that time, or even who paid attention to things or learned something about the history, these things would take you back to 1952. There were big demonstrations taking place in South Africa in 1952 against apartheid. Huge demonstration, because it was just being implemented heavily, apartheid. Okay, Harry Truman was president, and he decided he was not going to run for president again. He stepped aside so that a war hero by the name of Dwight D. Eisenhower was nominated to run on a Republican ticket, and his vice presidential pick was a guy by the name of Richard M. Nixon. That's right. 1952, Franklin National Bank issued the first bank credit card. Man, and look what they've done to us. Just to show you how different the world was at that time, in 1952, war with Japan officially ended with a treaty that had been signed by the United States and 47 other countries. 1952, that's right. Marines took part in an atomic explosion and training in Nevada. That's when they lined up Marines and told them, stand here. And they exploded an atomic bomb above their heads. That's right. And they told them, don't worry, it's not going to hurt you. Mr. Potato Head was introduced. Not that those two are related, but it is interesting, isn't it? Also in 1952, there was a TV show that began that year. And let me give you a sample of it.
Ladies and gentlemen, the story you're about to see is true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
Dragnet began as a television show in 1952. Let's see, Pee Wee Herman was born in 1952, as was Steve Reeves, who later became, no, not Steve Reeves, what's the other one? Yeah, Steve Reeves. He was born in 1952, as was a guy by the name of Robin Williams. He was born in Chicago in 1952. There were a lot of things just beginning in 1952. We were learning about DNA at that time. Christopher Reeve, that's what I meant to say. But in 1952, scientists were confirming that DNA had hereditary data in it. And they said, ooh, this could be important. And think about it, DNA has become like the new fingerprint. In 1952, that's when Richard Nixon gave his Checkers speech. And if you're not familiar with it, you can check out the history of it. And that was a very important speech that he gave dealing with his dog. But also, that was the first year that the first video recording on magnetic tape was made in L.A., 1952. So if it gives you a little idea of what the year 1952 was like. There was no cell phones. There was no internet. There was no CNN. There was no, you know, so many things that we take for granted today didn't even exist. Computers at that time were these huge, huge, huge things that took up whole floors, and only the biggest corporations owned them. And in Chicago, as well as across the country, there was this game that people played. Black people in particular, mostly, played this game called policy. Now, if you want an idea of what it was like, then you can just imagine this. When you think of the state lottery, that was policy. Let me go to the phone here and see who we've got on the line. Hello? Hello? Okay. Hi. Can you hear me? Hello? You might be hearing a they might be hearing, experiencing a delay. Hello, caller. All right. I'll go back to the phones in a minute. Our call-in line, by the way, is 646-915-8342. That's 646-915-8342. And in fact, in a couple of minutes, I'm expecting for Nathan Thompson, the acclaimed author and publisher of Kings, the True Story of Chicago's Policy Kings and Numbers Racketeers. He'll be calling in from the actual location where Ted Rowe was murdered on this date 57 years ago. And it ended a very important era in American history, and in particular in black history. You see, we had at that time a huge business enterprise that stretched from one end of the country to the other, and it's what allowed us to have a lot of other businesses. Let me take a second and say, hey, shout out to Young Black CEO. He's over in the chat room, as are two other guests. Good evening to you. Welcome to the program. This is Rush Hour, a very special Rush Hour. Tonight we are taking a look at the assassination of Ted Roe. And when I get Nathan Thompson on the phone from the actual location of his assassination, we'll go into a little bit more about who this Ted Roe was. If you know anybody from Chicago, and particularly any black people who are older than 50 years old, they can probably tell you that they know or remember who Ted Roe was. Let's see, who's this in here in the chat room? Don Dada Hats. Okay, welcome. Hope I said your name right. And you can text into the chat and I can see it. Okay? Understand that policy or the numbers was so huge that there was a family in Chicago, the Jones family. It was three brothers and their mother. They became the richest black family in America. And that's how huge policy was. And policy money at that time, it fueled so many black businesses, whether it was doctors, dentists, all kinds of businesses, because black people couldn't go to the regular banks and get loans to start their businesses. Virtually all of the first certified public accountants in the United States were certified in Chicago, and they worked in policy. Lawyers. It was huge. Policy money is what fueled the comeback of the Negro Baseball League. It fueled even the Negro Basketball League. Black people ran boxing. And it was the policy kings who were the managers of Joe Louis and others in the boxing game. The movie business, the music business, you name it. And that's what policy, or what we many people call the numbers racket, that's what fueled it. And so, as I said, there was a huge battle that jumped off to take over policy. And in the first, there were actually two policy wars. The first one, the mobs were successful in taking over policy in all the different cities across the country, Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, most of New York, up in Boston, Baltimore, St. Louis, all over the country except for two places. That was Chicago, an area called Bronzeville, and a part of New York up in Harlem. Okay, on the phone lines with me is Mr. Nathan Thompson. Are you on location yet?
I am sitting directly by the tree that Ted Roe died on.
Wow. Okay, I've been filling in our audience a little bit about just a brief outline about policy, and I have let them know that you spent almost 13 years researching and writing the definitive book on policy. But let's do this. For those that are not familiar with Ted Roe, let's start with that. Why should we care about Ted Roe in terms of his assassination 57 years ago on this date?
Well, the reason we should care about Ted Roe is because this was not only the last, but one of the few black men that ever stood up against what we know as the mafia, the mob, La Cosa Nostra, whatever you want to call it. You're talking about a man who said, you know what, to hell with y'all, and stood up, and he meant that. And you're talking about a man who stood up against a major force. I mean, certainly people know that the mob, the mafia, whatever you want to call them, have been and continue to be a major force in this country. So in Chicago alone, You're talking about an outfit, as they were known as the Chicago Outfit. Well, you're talking about a couple of few hundred guys who are members of this organization, all of them are packing pistols, and all of them at any given time will shoot to kill. That's what they do. That's what a gangster does.
Right.
You are a guy named Ted Rowe who has made all of these millions of dollars by way of your business organization. And this is something that has been very attractive to the Chicago mob for quite a number of years, to the point that, you know, Ted was the latest guy that they killed in the name of taking over this business enterprise. Now, what's significant in the 57 years since his murder is that you look at the level of legislation that has gone on, not only in Chicago, but in this country, in the name of establishing state lotteries. State lotteries are built on the success of the black numbers racket. And in Chicago, that was the top of the heap. Chicago was the policy capital of the world. So when you look at all of the money that has been generated by one state to the next through their state lotteries, and in most cases, particularly here in Illinois, there came a period of time when the state legislated that all of the revenues generated by this lottery game are going to be deposited into what was called a common school fund. In other words, the lottery was supposed to fund public education. Well, we all know what a disaster that has been in Illinois, and I'm sure that that's a mirror example from one state to the next. So when you look at the money that used to benefit the black community and no longer did and no longer does through what is now called the lottery, once upon a time was called policy, you're looking at the one black man that stood up as a safeguard to keep that money circulating in the black community. Look at what has happened to black communities since the prosperous days of the policy gang.
Wow. Yeah.
Now, so that's why it's significant, and that's why this date is significant.
Okay.
We in the United States of America here, we have holidays, and we celebrate a whole bunch of folks that really never had the interest of black folks in mind. So albeit an illegal enterprise, is something that was of supreme benefit to the black community during some very progressive days pre so-called civil rights era.
Right.
And when you remove that type of economic engine from a people, well, that's a recipe for what we are now experiencing. You look at the business corridors in our community, they are predominantly operated by people who look nothing like us. When you look at the state of our young people, it's because there's a whole level that probably expands into at least two generations that has been removed from the public school system in terms of, you know, I'm talking about things like civics classes. All of these types are important, and they were removed. So, you know, when somebody controls what you read, what you see, what you hear, and everything else, well, consequently, they control your behavior. So you've got a kid growing up with absence of knowledge of self and no knowledge of neighborhood pre his birth or her birth. You know, they're growing up in something that's not real, and they don't have any backstory to go with it. That's
right.
A recipe for disaster.
Now, we're talking with Nathan Thompson, the author and publisher of the Bronzeville Press's Kings, the True Story of Chicago's Policy Kings and Numbers Racketeers, which has become the definitive book on what we now know as what most people know as the state lotteries, but it was originally called policy. Just real quick, in fact, I had a question from the chat room. Don Dada Hat said, is it true that policy was thought to have begun because black folks couldn't get insurance? I was told that certain brothers in the black community would tell the black folks they could get insurance policies for them, but instead would take their money and play the numbers. Wow.
No, that is not true.
Right.
No, there's a whole historical origin of how the numbers game evolved over time. If you want to go back to the absolute origin, you know, betting on the numbers can be traced back to the Bible, biblical time. Various parts of the country had what they call lotteries, and I'm talking about in the, you know, 15, 16, and the 1700s, around the times when, you know, old, you know, universities like, you know, Harvard and Princeton were being built. A lot of those universities, in fact, those universities were built with lottery proceeds. Those things evolved, but they were more like sweepstakes as opposed to what we know as, you know, a daily lottery game. So this is something that has evolved and taken on many shapes and forms over, actually over the centuries. So by the time we get into the late 1800s and early 1900s, it's taken on yet different forms. So by the time it hit Chicago in 1885, it got here by way of a man we call Policy Sam Young, who came up from New Orleans. Now, they had lotteries and sweepstakes going on in New Orleans at that time, which had been banned by the federal government many years earlier. But basically, he took a concept of betting on the numbers and brought it up here and did his own thing with it. This is where we ended up with 12 numbers in those days. You know, it's called the two-legged book or the one-legged book. The two-legged book is 12 numbers. I'm sorry, 24 numbers, and the one-legged book is 12 numbers. That's how we got into that. But other parts of the country use the clearinghouse numbers, the stock market reports, you know, the last three numbers of one of those reports. That was mostly done in the East, Pittsburgh, parts of Ohio, where they had both things going on. They had clearinghouse and they had policy. So it's taken on many shapes and forms. But again, I want to stress that what we know today as the state lottery, wherever you live in this country, it is patterned after and built on the success of the black numbers rackets.
Now, let me say a shout out to Professor Riri, who just checked into the chat room. Says it's truly awesome and most informative. You know, that's one of the things. Now, just real quick, what got you started on this 13-year journey to research and write this book? You know, that has become such a, and I'm a personal witness, this book has literally changed people's lives as well as given us some valuable information about our history.
Well, I mean, you know, I've told this story a lot. It's a true story. What actually began my spark, so to speak, in this direction, it all began with I wanted to know what the brothers were doing back in the Capone days. You know, we talked a lot about, you know, the whole Italian gangster thing, the Chicago mob, Al Capone, when I was growing up. When I was growing up, the child of the 60s and into the 70s, there was something happening then that doesn't happen anymore. I don't know exactly when it stopped, but here in Chicago, we have WGN television, which around the world, that's, I guess it goes all over the country in different places. But when I was growing up, every year, like clockwork, it was a tradition that Channel 9 played, or I should say broadcast, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre that stars Jason Robards. I mean, that was, I were a guy, black, white, whatever, living in Chicago in the 60s and the 70s when they were running that show. Didn't matter what you were doing on Valentine's Day, whether you had a girlfriend or not, at some point you were going to get to a television and watch the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Well, what that actually did was give me the foundation for this story because it taught me that side of Chicago's history. So naturally it was a movie, so you got to figure half of it is pure Hollywood, but it gave me enough information to use in my research and start looking up all of these dates and informations and all these different things that were being discussed about Al Capone and Frank Nitti and all these guys and, you know, Mayor Cermak and all the stuff that was going on. Mm-hmm. Then the deeper I started getting into that, I started wondering, well, what were the brothers doing? You know, what were the boys getting back in the day? So there the journey begins. I went in the library one day, Woodson Library, to you know, look up and see what I could find out. I started with the Chicago Defender on microfilm, which the Chicago Defender newspaper is the oldest operating black newspaper in America. It began in 1905, but the earliest you can get it on microfilm at the public library is 1910. So I read every single edition of the Chicago Defender from 1910 to present day. And that provided the ultimate roadmap to what I was looking for. So from there, it was just a matter of cross-referencing, you know, 50 different sources and, you know, verifying one thing. And then from there, I moved on to personal stories of the elders. You know, I spent a god-awful amount of time with people in their 80s and 90s. In fact, I spent 30 minutes on the phone with one man who was 104 years old, and it took 30 minutes to get three questions answered.
Well, you know, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that was an experience in itself.
Well, you know, one of the things, and this is what happened with me when I first read the book, and I grew up in Chicago. I was born in Chicago, grew up in Chicago, and it filled in so much of the empty space because I had grown up knowing and hearing about how at one time black people had been so much and done so much, and yet all I could see was nothing. Something had happened, but nobody would tell me what had happened.
And well, you're talking about that our people were literally terrorized out of talking about. And I don't use that word loosely, all right? I mean, I am very particular about the words that I use. And when I say to you that they were terrorized, I want you to understand something here, that our people were under attack on two sides of the fence. And all of this was concurrent. On one side of the fence, you had the racketeers, the so-called underworld figures like Ted Rowe, the Jones Brothers, and all these policy guys.
Mm-hmm.
They were with the Chicago mob for damn near 20 years. So you're talking about a couple of hundred known guys from different parts of town that you know are out here gunning for your life. They've already killed many of your people, and they're trying to kill you.
When you say kill them, they were shooting, they were throwing bombs, they were doing all kinds of stuff, right?
Kidnapping the whole bit. Now, that's just on one side of the fence. Now, understand something here. Concurrently, there was something going on called the affordable housing racket that has long origins and roots in this city.
Mm.
As the mob and the Chicago police and the Cook County State's Attorney Police and the Cook County Sheriff were all ganging up on the policy boys, the rest of law enforcement was looking the other way when racist white boys were coming out of different neighborhoods like Bridgeport and attacking black people over here in the black neighborhood.
Mm.
This was all about the housing thing. During this period of time, we had things going on with these restrictive covenants where black people couldn't move into certain neighborhoods.
Right.
Well, it was being challenged on several fronts. That incited a lot of race riots. And the very idea that some or a black family was going to move into a potential area sent carloads of white boys over here to Bronzeville, the black neighborhood. So, I mean, that's a whole other discussion. But the point that I'm trying to make is that the black community was under severe terrorist attack by racist white Chicagoans on the underworld side of the fence and on the legitimate side of the fence concurrently.
Wow. Now, you know, one of the chatters, one of the listeners says, how can we get Hollywood or the Hughes or the Hudlin Brothers or Spike Lee to make a movie based on the Policy King's book? Hoodlum was good, but Ted Rowe and the Jones Brothers stories are truly amazing. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, she's right about that. The stories are truly amazing. Actually, Quincy Jones optioned the screen rights to the book. And at some point in the not-too-distant future, I would imagine we're going to be getting underway with that. You know, the Hollywood process, even before all the various personnel issues they had out there, there was the writer's strike, and there was the Screen Actors Guild, and then, you know, two or three other unions, including, I think, one of the producers' unions. All these strikes have gone on over the last 2 and 3 years. So they have done a lot at really, really, really just slowing down the process. And then with the economic crisis, you know, it's just been really tough getting particularly black films made.
Right. Now,
I believe that Quincy Jones is probably, you know, the person that can really push this thing through if anybody can do it, because he's got personal attachment to the story.
Right. Now, for those who would like, number one, to get more information, let me do this real quick. First of all, the book can be found, can be ordered at the website, which is policykings.com. One word, policykings.com. And if you go to the website for a limited time, you can actually download a very special commemorative piece that Nathan wrote in honor of Ted Rowe. It's a very nice piece. It's a download as a PDF that you can get in, at no cost if you do it within the next, you know,
well,
next few minutes.
It's
really a great piece that goes into not only history, a little bit about Ted Rowe, but also a little bit of history about policy.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's going to be up on the website. So,
yeah,
you know,
kidding.
People can always go there and download that. Probably we'll probably just leave it up there. I mean, it's already being put into some library catalogs here in Chicago, and I would imagine that it will move beyond that. But, you know, this is a very significant day in history, and I think that I wanted to do this because, you know, we always get the news about, you know, whether it's, you know, Al Capone or as we have right now,
Connor.
You know, the feature film that's out right now about John Dillinger and,
oh,
you know,
yeah.
These kind of things pop up in the news all the time. And some, you know, I remember when Tony Accardo, who at one time was the boss of the Chicago mob, his house out in River Forest went up for sale. And, you know, all the newspapers jumped on it and they had it in the real estate sections. And, you know, you get all these different things. So, consequently, those ethnic groups grow up with well-rounded knowledge of their histories as
right.
a people here. But our history has never been given the same type of attention or level of importance attached to it. Consequently, we have a severe problem with our young people who have little regard for life, much less for their own lives and the history of their lives. Is related.
No self-esteem and no respect. Just real briefly, let's talk a little bit about this. When we talk about the policy kings and the policy era, give us a sense of when we talk about how much they did and how much was going on. I mean, people really can't get a picture of it out of because there's no frame of reference. So when we talk about, like you talk about the, Tony Accardo's house and different things, the policy kings owned and ran so much. Give us a little sense of that.
Well, let's see here. From the contributions that the revenues from the business made, we're talking about the thing that financed the Negro baseball leagues. We're talking about money that financed Provident Hospital. We're talking about money that financed Burr Oak Cemetery.
Mm.
We're talking about that financed political careers, such as Congressman William Dawson and many others, Oscar DePriest, just all kinds of people. You're talking about money that financed insurance companies like Supreme Liberty Life Insurance Company and Metropolitan Assurance Company. You're talking about money that established banks. You're talking about money that established drugstores. You're talking about money that established grocery stores. You're talking about money that established men's apparel and women's apparel retail outlets. You're talking about money that established taverns and bars and entertainment venues. You're talking about money that tried to get a black basketball league off the ground. You're talking about money that financed professional sport careers like Joe Louis and scores of professional boxers and baseball players. You're talking about money that financed the careers of entertainers. Lena Horne's father was a big shot policy guy out in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. I mean, on and on and on. Good Lord. You know, anything that is a business enterprise, these guys had money tied up into it. One of the famous stories is that your listeners are familiar with the name Colonel John Robinson, who originates out of Gulfport, Florida, came to Chicago as a mechanic, got hooked up with the boys and gambling and whatnot, got into trouble, went up to Detroit, opened up a garage up there, hooked up with a guy named Coffee. They came back to Chicago and eventually first became the first black students at a major U.S. aeronautical school. Then they built an airplane, and they did all of that and got women involved, and women became pilots, did all of that, which was already history, all right? John Robinson leaves America and goes to work for Haile Selassie in Ethiopia as his personal pilot. He built the Air Force. That's a whole nother story going on. He comes back to Chicago in 1936. They establish an aeronautical school on South Parkway, which is now King Drive. Gets that off the ground, does all that. The Jones boys come along and kick in some more money, so they finance this cross-country trip that these two brothers took. There was history in the making. It happened. Did all of that. Then he goes back to Ethiopia after Britain restores him, restores Selassie back to the Ethiopian throne. Selassie sends for John Robinson. John Robinson is back. So the tentacle.
Wow.
You're talking about tentacles that come out of Bronzeville that virtually wrap around the world during some of the most historical times on this planet. Policy,
now,
policy, these men who controlled it all, and the things and the money and the causes that they contributed to went on to help finance other things that in their own right became historical things, historical markers in the timeline of Africans in America.
Including Marcus Garvey. I mean, there seems to be nothing that that black people were involved in that there wasn't some kind of connection with policy, money, or businessmen who were policy racketeers. Now, again, we're talking with Nathan Thompson, who's the author of Kings, The True Story of Chicago's Policy Kings and Numbers Racketeers. You can find out more about this if you go to the website, which is policykings.com. And now, you're standing literally, you said, by the tree where Ted Rowe.
I'm actually sitting in the van here with Committeeman Waylon Johnson. We're sitting right here parked where Ted Rowe's car was parked 57 years ago, right in front of the tree that he died on. And I got to tell you something, man, we've been sitting here just kind of absorbing the vibes.
Yeah.
As I sit here and just kind of digging the scene, we're sitting 57 years ago in the middle of a solidly black neighborhood on a block where the biggest big shot in town lives at. So everybody on the block knows this guy. Some of his crew live right on this block. And two gunmen come out from both sides of the building. Now, on the south end of the building is the corner where at that time there was a standard gas station with big billboards. And one of the gunmen comes out from behind that billboard where he had been there for a long time. Keep in mind that that gas station was owned by a black man.
Hmm.
So I'm sitting here thinking about how two Italian guys can sit here in the middle of the black neighborhood at 10 o'clock on an August night. It was probably a lot hotter then than it is tonight. How they can sit there and lay in wait for this brother. And I'm looking at all the buildings directly across the street from Ted Rowe's home, and you know, I don't know how many people had air conditioning back in those days, but there had to be some open windows going on in August in Chicago in 1950.
Oh, yeah.
So just as soon as gunshots are ringing out, and we're talking about 5 shotgun blasts, 12-gauge shotgun, that's a lot of noise.
Yeah.
So clearly folks had to be rushing to their windows. And I would imagine at least half of them probably thought that they knew what it was before they got to that window, because everybody in town knows that this war between Ted Rowe and the Chicago mob is in full effect.
Right.
You know, remember, we're talking
about
just a year prior
mm-hmm.
That Ted Rowe killed Fat Lenny Cofano. Fat Lenny Cofano was godfather to Sam Giancana's daughter, Antoinette. And he's also the brother of Marshall Cofano, who was the Chicago mob's man in L.A. at that time.
Now, we're talking about made mob guys, and Ted Roe actually killed Fat Lenny Cofano when they were trying to kill him. And so here's a black man who killed a made mob guy.
Hold on. This is 1952, so we're talking a black guy who just killed a made Italian mobster. But we are also talking about B, a black man who killed a white man.
Yes, that's right.
This is 1952.
Yes, yes, yes. And
this
he
is serious
lived
shit.
To tell about it. He was still walking around.
That's right. I mean, you're talking about the one guy that stood up against all of this, man. I mean,
wow.
You know, I know some pretty strong white men that ain't never stood up against the mob.
Now, when Ted Roe died that night, literally within minutes, as I understand it, the picture I have in my head that you've given us, is that literally that whole block was just filled with hundreds of people. And the word spread that Ted Roe had been killed.
I mean, the whole neighborhood was out here, man. The whole neighborhood was out here, man.
And then at his funeral, let's talk just for a quick minute about his funeral. As I understand it, how many cars were in the funeral procession?
I think it was 81, if I'm not mistaken.
81 cars. Now, we're talking about 1952. Not everybody had cars, but
81
cars in the funeral procession.
81 Cadillacs and Lincolns and Packards and all of that.
Wow. And he had it at his funeral was at whose church?
At the First Deliverance Church, which is the church of the good Reverend Clarence Cobb, who in those days was known as the God of the Underworld.
Wow. Wow.
Church, which still stands today. It was very modern at the time. You know, originally Cobb had a church, and then through some of this mafia activity, that church got burned down. So they went to rebuild, and a lot of Ted Roe's money was put into rebuilding that church, and that's why that funeral was held there.
Well, now, we just have a few more minutes left, but I want to talk for just a couple of minutes about the aftermath of Ted Roe's death and the end of the policy era as we know it, and what occurred in not just Bronzeville, but in Bronzeville and Chicago, but across the country, but in terms of, you mentioned a little bit about it earlier, but what are some of the realistic things that occurred on a real-life basis? What came in to fill that vacuum?
Well, what immediately happened was that the Italians came in and took over the neighborhood. They took over the policy racket. They took over all of the policy king's other operations in taverns, nightclubs, the talent.
Music
that was
business.
All of that, anything that dealt with the unions. Because remember, the mob had a real tight grip on the unions. So any of their other business operations that had anything to do with the unions, such as the case of all the taverns and lounges that they owned, where you're talking about the bar waiters and bartenders unions and that kind of thing. Ed Jones had the Hawthorne Milk Delivery franchise, so you're talking about Teamsters guys, the truckers. All these various unions that tied into this, they had control over. So when we talk about a takeover, it's one thing to say that, you know, this one group took over this other group's territory and their business. But what that actually means is that a bunch of grown adult black men who had controlled businesses for years and years had been replaced by young, and when I say young, I'm talking about 19, 20, 21, 22-year-old white boys, Italian boys, who are coming in here telling grown-ass men what to do under the threat of murder.
Wow.
That has been, that's the thing. It is the idea of murder, which had been proven time and time again up until this point. So as, once you weed out all of the warriors, all of the fighters, and you're down to just the common folks will always fall in line because there's nobody to fight for them.
Wow.
And therein lies the tragedy of black America.
And a lot of the vacuum was filled with drugs.
Oh, yeah. You're talking about the shadow economy of yesterday was replaced with the shadow economy of today, and that's what we know as crack cocaine and heroin and angel dust and Thai stick and weed and
LSD.
Who the heck knows what else people are shoving up their noses and arms these days, but that's what happened. So again, that's why I mean that therein lies the destruction of Black America. Once you remove all of the positive, strong pillars and replace them with weak pillars, people will perish because there's nobody to fight for them.
Right. Now,
the average person ain't...
Professor that's in the chat room said he would like to, for Nate to speak to my classes at some point. You can contact us through the website at policykings.com. Now, Nathan has been in great demand at various places, particularly what did you get, about a five-year run at Northwestern University, where there are people who have come to understand that this is an important historical book, important history, even though it is not traditional.
I got to point out one thing here that is super overall about this. One thing that your listeners, you really must understand and take to heart. This whole thing about policy we're talking about, particularly as it applies here in Chicago, but, of course, across the country to wherever there was a Black community, but you're talking about the catalyst that converted the Black vote from Republican to Democrat.
Right, right. And that's a whole story in of itself.
We have not looked back as a people. We have not looked back ever since. And most Black people don't know that, therefore don't understand, because most of us vote the way our moms and dads voted. You're born, you're raised in the household. When you're old enough to vote, a lot of what you're going to do in that voting booth, you know, has to do with your mom and dad and how you were raised in the household. So if you were traditionally raised in a Democratic household, chances are good you're going to end up voting Democratic. Few have stepped outside of that circle to carve out their own niche. Those that have done so with a measure of some knowledge other than what they had been taught in the household, and they chose to exercise their right at that time. But predominantly, Black folks are still Democrat, and it is for those reasons. But the knowledge of it has been lost over time. It's part of the same, I loosely call this conspiracy of silence, but it has more to do with the reasons that Black folks stopped talking about those good old days because there was so much murder and mayhem attached to it. Because you're talking about 1952, after all that shit hit the fan, Black folks started moving up out of Chicago. And you can look at, there's a diagram, a graph in that commemorative that I put out that shows the census tract from the U.S. Census Bureau showing the depopulation decline. Right after 1952, there's a huge, almost straight down drop where folks beat it up out of here, man, because the neighborhood wasn't the same. In fact, it has been said that Brownsville died that night, too, when Ted Rowe died.
Well, Don Dada Hat says, I grew up on the west side in the Austin area. Whenever I drive through the Brownsville area, or he says Brownsville, but we want to make clear, it's called Brownsville, because there is a Brownsville, various cities named Brownsville. There's one in Texas, New York. But we're talking about Brownsville, which was a name that was given to describe particularly where Black people lived. But it was focused at one time in a certain area of the south side of Chicago. But he says, I find myself visually seeing the stories depicted in this book. But it was also on the west side. It was everywhere.
Yeah. For your listener out there who's talking about the west side, the big policy boss on the west side was Big Jim Martin, James C. Martin. He was the number two man in the Black Chicago Policy Syndicate, the Big 12 Policy Syndicate. When the deal was cut in 1932 with the Democratic Party, the bosses of the Democratic Party at that time, one of those bosses was Pat Nash, who was the county, Cook County head of the Cook County Central Democratic Committee, some long title. But the point is, prior to him having that post, he served as a West Side alderman at one time in his earlier political career. So that was
right.
part of the catalyst that allowed for basically the Policy Kings to do what they want to do, free of police interference, in exchange for delivering the black vote. Well, Big Jim Martin was the man on the West Side that delivered that black vote.
What was it called? Martin's Corner, which Martin's a lot of the old timers would remember.
1900 West Lake Street, right at the corner of Lake and Damon. That was Martin's spot. It was called Martin's Corner. Big, I think it had two or three stories to it. Big nightclub, a lot of live entertainment. You're talking about cats like Ray Nance. They don't talk about it, but Duke Ellington and all of those guys who were the big jazz dudes in those days. A lot of them were playing over there at Big Jim's Club. Ray Nance did a lot of gigs over there. Of course, there was a lot of gambling going on, and he ran part of his policy operations out of there, and you know, that kind of thing. But you know, all the black high rollers, man, from across the country. I mean, this is where they came. They came to Chicago. They hit the South Side. They went to the Palm Tavern. They went to all these clubs affiliated with the Policy Kings. They went on the West Side to Big Jim spots. I mean, you know.
And then there was the nightclub. What was the name of the nightclub that was described back then as rivaling anything in Monte Carlo?
Oh, that was the casino. That was the Kelly Brothers casino, called the Tijuana Club, but it was commonly referred to as the Keno Club. It sat at 51st in Michigan. And
wow.
I mean, you're talking like, you know, Bojangles and Duke Ellington and all these cats used to gamble in this place, man. You know, a lot of chrome going on in this place.
Well, listen, we got less than about a minute left here. I want to, first of all, thank you, Nathan Thompson, the author and publisher of the Bronzeville Press and the author of Kings, the True Story of Chicago's Policy Kings and Numbers Racketeers, which can be found at the website policykings.com. And you can also download the special commemorative that Nathan did for the 57th anniversary of the assassination of Ted Roe. I appreciate you taking the time and sharing this with us tonight and all the callers. And all the listeners.
My pleasure.
All right. And we'll have to do this again. So as folks get the book and learn more about it, we'll look at some of the other anniversaries.
All right.
Take care.
Good talking to you and your people, man. You have a good one.
All right.
All right now.
That brings us to the close of this program. I want to thank you all for listening. Again, this has been Rush Hour, a very special anniversary, the assassination of Ted Roe. And again, just so that you can get the information, you can go to the website, policykings.com. I want to thank Don Dada Hats and Professor Riri, Young Black CEO, guest number 6391, and all the other listeners out there, and appreciate you. And if you would please send us your comments. And you can do that at the email at the website policykings.com. All right? I'm going to close out with a little piece from that time period, something that some people may recognize.
Hey-o. Hey-o. Daylight come and me want go home. Say, me say day, me say day, me say day, me say day, me say day. Daylight come and me want.